Hello and welcome to Swiss Info's program for March 14th. I'm Susan Masika in Bern. You can't see it, but it's steadily degrading the environment. CO2, the catalyst of global warming. Is Switzerland doing its share to cut greenhouse gas emissions? Not everybody thinks so.
And in such a situation, to see that Switzerland is not actually doing what science asks is indeed a shameful thing.
Also this week, we go behind the scenes at a session of the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change.
You go out and have a beer to discuss further, and it's fun, and it's also really hard work.
And they're on their way. Switzerland's Solar Impulse team and its message on the potential of clean and renewable energy.
Okay, that's good. I switched from number two to number one, from number one to number two.
50%. That's how much Switzerland plans to reduce its greenhouse gas emissions by 2030. That's 50% of the 1990 emission level, which was 8 tons per capita per year. Today it's 6.4 tons per person. Altogether, Switzerland, with its population of 8 million, is responsible for 0.1% of global greenhouse gas emissions. That doesn't sound too bad, yet environmentalists say that the Swiss have to do more. People like Patrick Hofstetter, the head of WWF Switzerland's Climate and Energy Division.
We have the ingredients for concentrated action. And what we have is also a situation where it has been so far a benefit to Switzerland to actually do climate action. So in terms of finance, Switzerland has profited from all the measures it has taken so far to reduce the use of fossil fuels and reduce CO2 emissions. And in such a situation, to see that Switzerland is not actually doing what science asks is indeed a shameful thing.
At the Federal Office of the Environment, Andrea Burkhardt, head of the Climate Division, said others felt that the Swiss were being too ambitious.
Other critics said this target is too high. So we're quite confident that we found the right balance between these two opinions. And I think we do have the measures according to this target.
Switzerland has already met its targets for round one of the Kyoto Protocol, a global agreement to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. The Swiss commitment for the 2013 to 2020 period has been increased. Its CO2 Act calls for a 20% reduction in emissions through domestic measures. Hofstetter of WWF says that this is something that's already been successful in the heating sector.
Switzerland did reduce the emissions rather considerably in the whole heating sector. So there we have some success. We see that regulation works. And so this is certainly very, very positive.
But emissions caused by the transport sector are a big problem, even in a country where public transit is so popular.
Everybody would assume that transportation is not really a problem in Switzerland, but the reality is that emissions from transportation have increased a lot due to both very inefficient cars, big heavy cars that emit a lot, plus the mileage has increased a lot.
Burkhardt and the Environment Office also emphasize the importance of sustainable transport and heating systems.
And I think we do have a lot of potential, especially in the transport sector, where we see emissions still growing over the past decade, where we do have a lot of potential for further reduction, and also in the housing sector, where more refurbished building would help towards a carbon-free economy, and also industrial production, where there's still room for more improvement.
Well, it's one thing to have federal regulations, but what can ordinary people do to reduce their carbon footprints?
Well, there's a lot of things you can do in your daily life. You see what products you buy. Also, to watch out for room temperature in winter times. Maybe you cut down the heating a little bit. And then if you have a choice of different products, you might opt for the less carbon-intensive product.
And as Hofstetter pointed out, eating habits can also make a difference.
Don't waste food, so don't throw away. Actually eat what you buy. That's probably the first and also rather easy thing. Do management also of your fridge.
And when food shopping, he said to remember that meat production involves a lot of CO2.
WWF recommends reduce to the max. It's not forbidden to eat meat and to have fun with it, but reduce the amount.
UNFCCC, which stands for anybody? It's short for the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. Quite a mouthful. It's also full of input, with 196 parties involved, including nearly every country. They're trying to hammer out an agreement to get the planet on track for a low-carbon future. Delegates gathered in Geneva recently to prepare for the climate summit that'll be held in Paris this December. They came up with an 86-page document that they can use in their negotiations. In Paris, the goal is for everybody to commit to a strict new agreement to limit global warming. The head of the Swiss delegation told me it was good to have everybody's position represented, even if it meant a terribly long text.
It's less ambitious what we wanted at the beginning, but there's also a certain benefit of having that at the end.
That was Franz Perret, the Swiss Environment Office's ambassador for the environment. I met him in Geneva, where he let me tag along as he rushed from meeting to meeting at the UN's Palace of Nations. I asked him about Switzerland's reputation at events like these.
So everybody has a strong interest and not ready to be someone here without own self-interest and just playing a bridge-building role. That's not our function. We have to defend our interests here. But we do it differently than the US or China, who are in a different position, of course. And I think that's one of the added value that we are having. We are seen as, in principle, environmentally friendly, as being ambitious, so not a neutral country, but a country that is listening to different proposals. My impression is that this is seen like that a little bit. When we are making a proposal, it's looked at more in a more friendly manner than if the same proposal is coming or similar proposals coming from a different country, because our proposals tend to be also a little bit more different. I think the reason why we are having such a strong position here compared with the size of the countries and the emissions of our country is because we are very active, we are making many proposals, we are well connected and bringing parties together, like the different events we're doing with key players together, and that's also why they want us there, because they see we are able to bring new ideas in.
Maybe that's what you'd expect a man in Perret's role to say. So I looked around for corroboration. Although lots of people in the hall stopped Perret for a friendly chat and a handshake, I had trouble finding people to comment formally on Switzerland's role in climate negotiations. Then I spotted a group sitting outside on the ground, including a man in a colorful hooded sweater. It was Chris Wright, a member of a project called Adopt a Negotiator, part of the global call for climate action. The Australian climate researcher spoke well of Switzerland's efforts.
So Switzerland's always very traditionally been strong on ensuring accountability measures and transparency measures within the UNFCCC. But I think what a lot of parties here are ready for is a more positive approach to the negotiations, whereby Switzerland gets right behind some of the more universal themes of the negotiations, including human rights, including intergenerational equity, and as well as pushing stronger. I think Switzerland has a great leadership opportunity to push for much stronger mitigation targets, even targets that are as strong as some of the small island countries that are proposing.
He also pointed out the Swiss tendency to collaborate with countries from all over the globe.
And Switzerland has always traditionally kind of broke the borders. They've negotiated with Mexico, and is one of the few countries who negotiate very, very far away from, I guess, their traditional geographical groupings. And I really hope that they can use that kind of diplomacy experience to link in with some of the more progressive measures that are on the table here, and make sure that they don't go off the table, all the while ensuring that they have important transparency and accountability measures to make sure that they actually get implemented.
Back inside at the UN Serpent Bar, delegates from around the world were chatting over coffee and snacks. According to Perret, this informal networking outside of the sessions is really important. Mealtime is prime time for that. In Geneva, the Swiss climate team had something planned for nearly every lunch and dinner, making for some very long days.
What I really like in this delegation is the atmosphere. It's really a very collegial atmosphere, and people like to work together. And it's also impressive how much they work here. So in the evening when you're coming back from a dinner at 11, half past 11, you go out and have a beer to discuss further, and it's fun, and it's also really hard work. And in parallel to the work we're doing here, each of us is doing stuff for Bern. Like one colleague has to go back tomorrow, actually, for a very important session. And so this is sometimes not seen, how people are really working, well, nearly 24 hours doing the work here and for Bern, but in a very motivated manner. And that's a huge pleasure, I think. Not all delegations have that good atmosphere, I think.
Pere told me that the climate summit in Lima, Peru last December was also a good team-building experience.
In Lima, what was really funny, our delegation office was probably the loudest of all the delegation office because there was much of laughter and fun, but that was an expression also of being motivated and to enjoy to work together. And that's a complete different atmosphere than if you have to have... We also have fights, of course, oppositions. Of course we do have that, but that's a different manner than because it's based on mutual trust and confidence.
The next negotiating session before the Paris summit will be held in Bonn, Germany, in June.
Okay. Heading more than gates, midstream and gates. Clean at 30 knots.
On March 9th, the Swiss Solar Impulse began its round-the-world tour. Pilot and project CEO André Borschberg was in the cockpit for the first leg, flying from Abu Dhabi in the United Arab Emirates to Muscat in Oman.
André, c'est Albert. Écoutez, bravo. C'était superbe arrivée. On a vu de très belles images et vraiment félicitations pour ce premier vol magnifique.
That was Prince Albert of Monaco congratulating Borschberg upon landing. The Mission Control Center for Solar Impulse is located in Monaco. After a short pit stop, founder and pilot Bertrand Piccard hopped into the cockpit for leg two.
Thank you. Yes, I have to concentrate to speak slowly, otherwise you understand nothing when I have the oxygen mask on.
He flew over the Arabian Sea to Ahmedabad in India, a 1,468-kilometer journey, which broke the world record for the longest solar flight. With a wingspan somewhat wider than that of a Boeing 747, the Solar Impulse is supposed to serve as an inspiration for clean technology. Thanks to powerful batteries, it can fly day and night on solar power alone. The biggest challenge of the 35,000-kilometer voyage will be crossing the Pacific and Atlantic Oceans. To do that, the plane will have to fly non-stop for 120 hours. That's 5 days and five nights, a feat that it has never attempted. Visit us at swissinfo.ch for the latest on that adventure, as well as other stories related to climate change. Thank you for listening, and thank you to studio technician Daniel Wheeler. I'm Susan Masika.
Well, I think it's fine building jumbo planes, taking a ride on a cosmic train. Switch on summer from a slot machine. Just get what you want to if you want, as you can get anything. I know we've come a long way, we're changing day to day, but tell me, where do the children play? Well, you roll on roads over fresh green grass for your lorry loads, pumping petrol.